Chapter 22. Man, who never called attention to his treasures. The great palace in Milan was a gloomy house for a girl to enter. Roberto and his sister lived in it, as if it had been a monastery, going nowhere and receiving only those who labored for the cause. To Faustina, accustomed to the easy Austrian society, the Sunday evening receptions at the Palazzo Siviano must have seemed as dreary as a scientific congress. It pleased Roberto to regard her as a victim of barbarian insolence, an embodiment of his country desecrated by the desire of the enemy. But though, like any handsome penniless girl, Faustina had now and then been exposed to a free looker, a familiar word, I doubt if she connected such incidents with the political condition of Italy. She knew, of course, that in marrying Siviano she was entering a house closed against the Austrian. One of Siviano's first cares had been to pension his father-in-law, with the stipulation that Intolvi should resign his appointment and give up all relations with the government. And the old hypocrite, only too glad to purchase idleness on such terms, embraced the liberal cause with a zeal which left his daughter no excuse for half-heartedness. But he found it less easy than he had expected to recover a footing among his own people. In spite of his patriotic bluster, the Milanese held aloof from him, and being the kind of man who must always take his glass in company, he gradually drifted back to his old associates. It was impossible to forbid Faustina to visit her parents, and in their house she breathed an air that was at least tolerant of Austria. But I must not let you think that the young countess appeared ungrateful or unhappy. She was silent and shy, and it needed a more enterprising temper than Roberto's to break down the barrier between them. They seemed to talk to one another through a convent grating, rather than across a hearth. But if Roberto had asked more of her than she could give, outwardly she was a model wife. She chose me at once as her confessor, and I watched over the first steps of her new life. Never was younger sister tenderer to her elder than she to Donna Mariana. Never was young wife more mindful of her religious duties, kinder to her dependents, more charitable to the poor. Yet to be with her was like living in a room with shuttered windows. She was always the caged bird, the transplanted flower. For all Roberto's care, she never bloomed or sang. Donna Mariana was the first to speak of it. The child needs more light and air, she said. Light? Air? Roberto repeated. Does she not go to Mass every morning? Does she not drive on the Corso every evening? Donna Mariana was not called clever, but her heart was wiser than most women's heads. At our age, brother, said she, the windows of the mind face north and look out on a landscape full of lengthening shadows. Faustina needs another outlook. She is as pale as a hyacinth grown in a cellar. Roberto himself turned pale, and I saw that as he had uttered his own thought. You want me to let her go to Gemma's, he exclaimed. Let her go wherever there is a little careless laughter. Laughter now, he cried, with a gesture toward the somber line of portraits above his head. Let her laugh while she can, my brother. That evening after dinner he called Faustina to him. My child, he said, go and put on your jewels. Your sister Gemma gives a ball tonight, and the carriage waits to take you there. I am too much of a recluse to be at ease in such scenes, but I have sent word to your father to go with you. Andrea and Gemma welcomed their young sister-in-law with effusion, and from that time she was often in their company. Gemma forbade any mention of politics in her drawing room, and it was natural that Faustina should be glad to escape from the solemn conclaves of the Palazzo Siviano to a house where life went as gaily as in that villa above Florence, where Boccaccio's careless storytellers took refuge from the plague. But meanwhile the political distemper was rapidly spreading, and in spite of Gemma's Austrian affiliations it was no longer possible for her to receive the enemy openly. It was whispered that her door was still ajar to her old friends, but the rumor may have risen from the fact that one of the Austrian cavalry officers stationed at Milan was her own cousin, the son of the Anton whose misalliance the old count had so often bantered her. No one could blame the Countess Gemma for not turning her own flesh and blood out of doors, and the social famine to which the officers of the garrison were reduced made it natural that young Wolkenstern should press the claims of consanguinity. All this must have reached Roberto's ears, but he made no sign and his wife came and went as she pleased. When they returned the following year to the old dusky villa at Siviano, she was like the voice of a brook in a twilight wood. One could not look at her without ransacking the spring for new similes to paint her freshness. With Roberto it was different. I found him older, more preoccupied and silent, but I guessed that his preoccupations were political, for when his eye rested on his wife it cleared like the lake when a cloud shadow lifts from it. Count Andrea and his wife occupied an adjoining villa, and during the villeggiatura the two households lived almost as one family. Roberto, however, was often absent in Milan, called thither on business of which the nature was not hard to guess. Sometimes he brought back guests to the villa, and on these occasions Faustina and Donna Mariana went to Count Andrea's for the day. I have said that I was not in his confidence. But he knew my sympathies were with the liberals and now and then he let fall a word of the work going on underground. Meanwhile the new pope had been elected, and from Piedmont to Calabria we hailed in him the banner that was to lead our hosts to war. So time passed, and we reached the last months of 47. The villa on Iseo had been closed since the end of August. Roberto had no great liking for his gloomy palace in Milan, and it had been his habit to spend 9 months of the year at Siviano, but he was now too much engrossed in his work to remain away from Milan, and his wife and sister had joined him there as soon as the midsummer heat was over. During the autumn he had called me once or twice to the city to consult me on business connected with his fruit farms. And in the course of our talks he had sometimes let fall a hint of graver matters. It was in July of that year that a troop of Croats had marched into Ferrara with muskets and cannon loaded. The lighted matches of their cannon had fired the sleeping hate of Austria, and the whole country now echoed the Lombard cry "Colon out with the barbarian." All talk of adjustment, compromise, reorganization, shriveled on lips that the live coal of patriotism had touched. Italy for the Italians, and then monarchy, federation, republic, it mattered not what. The oppressor's grip had tightened on our throats, and the clear-sighted saw well enough that Metternich's policy was to provoke a rebellion, and then crush it under the Croat heel. But it was too late to cry prudence in Lombardy. With the first days of the new year the tobacco riots had drawn blood in Milan. Soon afterward the Lions Club was closed, and edicts were issued forbidding the singing of Pio Nono's hymn, the wearing of white and blue, the collecting of subscriptions for the victims of the riots. To each prohibition Milan returned a fresh defiance. The ladies of the nobility put on mourning for the rioters who had been shot down by the soldiery. Half the members of the Guardia Noble resigned, and Count Borromeo sent back his golden fleece to the emperor. Fresh regiments were continually pouring into Milan, and it was no secret that Radetzky was strengthening the fortifications. Late in January several leading liberals were arrested and sent into exile, and 2 weeks later martial law was proclaimed in Milan. At the first arrest several members of the Liberal Party had hastily left Milan, and I was not surprised to hear, a few days later, that orders had been given to reopen the villa at Siviano. The Count and Countess arrived there early in February. It was 7 months since I had seen the Countess, and I was struck with the change in her appearance. She was paler than ever, and her step had lost its lightness. Yet she did not seem to share her husband's political anxieties. One would have said that she was hardly aware of them. She seemed wrapped in a veil of lassitude, like Iseo on a still gray morning when dawn is blood red on the mountains, but a mist blurs its reflection in the lake. I felt as though her soul were slipping away from me, and longed to win her back to my care. But she made her ill health a pretext for not coming to confession, and for the present I could only wait and carry the thought of her to the altar. She had not been long at Siviano before I discovered that this drooping mood was only one phase of her humor. Now and then she flung back the cowl of melancholy, and laughed life in the eye. But next moment she was in shadow again, and her muffled thoughts had given us the slip. She was like a lake on one of those days, when the wind blows 20 ways, and every promontory holds a gust in ambush. Meanwhile there was a continual coming and going of messengers between Siviano and the city. They came mostly at night, when the household slept, and were away again with the last shadows. But the news they brought stayed and widened, shining through every cranny of the old house. The whole of Lombardy was up. From Pavia to Mantua, from Como to Brescia, the streets ran blood like the arteries of one great body. At Pavia and Padua the universities were closed. The frightened viceroy was preparing to withdraw from Milan to Verona, and Radetzky continued to pour his men across the Alps, till 100,000 were massed between the Piave and the Ticino. And now every eye was turned to Turin. Ah, how we watched for the blue banner of Piedmont on the mountains. Charles Albert was pledged to our cause. His whole people had armed to rescue us. The streets echoed with Avanti, Savoia. And yet Savoy was silent and hung back. Each day was a lifetime strained to the cracking point with hopes and disappointments. We reckoned the hours by rumors, the very minutes by hearsay. Then suddenly, it was worth living through. Word came to us that Vienna was in revolt. The points of the compass had shifted and our sun had risen in the north. I shall never forget that day at the villa. Roberto sent for me early, and I found him smiling and resolute, as becomes a soldier on the eve of action. He had made all his preparations to leave for Milan, and was awaiting a summons from his party. The whole household felt that great events impended, and Donna Mariana, awed and tearful, had pleaded with her brother that they should all receive the sacrament together the next morning. Roberto and his sister had been to confession the previous day, but the Countess Faustina had again excused herself. I did not see her while I was with the Count, but as I left the house she met me in the laurel walk. The morning was damp and cold, and as she had drawn a black scarf over her hair, and walked with a listless dragging step. But at my approach she lifted her head quickly, and signed to me to follow her into one of the recesses of clipped laurel that bordered the path. "Don Egidio," she said, "you have heard the news?" I assented. "The Count goes to Milan tomorrow?" "It seems probable, Your Excellency." "There will be fighting. We are on the eve of war, I mean." "We are in God's hands, Your Excellency." "In God's hands," she murmured. Her eyes wandered and for a moment we stood silent. Then she drew a purse from her pocket. I was forgetting," she exclaimed. "Tea this is for, that poor girl you spoke to me about the other day. What was her name? The girl who met the Austrian soldier at the fair at Peschiera." "Ah, Vanina," I said. "But she is dead, Your Excellency." "Dead?" She turned white, and the purse dropped from her hand. I picked it up, and held it out to her, but she put back my hand. "Tea that is for masses, then," she said. And with that she moved away toward the house. I walked on to the gate, but before I had reached it, I heard her step behind me. "Don Egidio," she called, and I turned back. "You are coming to say mass in the chapel tomorrow morning?" "That is the Count's wish." She wavered a moment. I am not well enough to walk up to the village this afternoon," she said at length. "Will you come back later and hear my confession here?" "Willingly, Your Excellency." "Come at sunset then." She looked at me gravely. "It is a long time since I have been to confession," she added. "My child, the door of heaven is always unlatched." She made no answer, and I went my way. I returned to the villa a little before sunset, hoping for a few words with Roberto. I felt with Faustina that we were on the eve of war, and the uncertainty of the outlook made me treasure every moment of my friend's company. I knew he had been busy all day, but hoped to find that his preparations were ended, and that he could spare me a half hour. I was not disappointed, for the servant who met me asked me to follow him to the Count's apartment. Roberto was sitting alone, with his back to the door, at a table spread with maps and papers. He stood up, and turned an ashen face on me. "Roberto!" I cried, as if we had been boys together. He signed to me to be seated. "Egidio," he said suddenly, "my wife has sent for you to confess her? The Countess met me on my way home this morning, and expressed a wish to receive the sacrament tomorrow morning with you and Donna Mariana, and I promised to return this afternoon to hear her confession." Roberto sat silent, staring before him, as though he hardly heard. At length he raised his head, and began to speak. "You have noticed lately that my wife has been ailing?" he asked. "Everyone must have seen that the Countess is not in her usual health. She has seemed nervous, out of spirits. I have fancied that she might be anxious about your excellency." He leaned across the table, and laid his wasted hand on mine. "See, call me Roberto," he said. There was another pause, before he went on. "Since I saw you this morning," he said slowly, "something horrible has happened. After you left I sent for Andrea and Gemma, to tell them the news from Vienna, and the probability of my being summoned to Milan before night. You know as well as I, that we have reached a crisis. There will be fighting within 24 hours, if I know my people, and war may follow sooner than we think. I felt it my duty to leave my affairs in Andrea's hands, and to entrust my wife to his care. Don't look startled," he added with a faint smile. "And no reasonable man goes on a journey without setting his house in order, and if things take the turn I expect it may be some months before you see me back at Siviano. But it was not to hear this that I sent for you." He pushed his chair aside and walked up and down the room with his short limping step. "My God!" he broke out wildly, "how can I say it? When Andrea had heard me, I saw him exchange a glance with his wife, and she said with that infernal sweet voice of hers, 'Yes, Andrea, it is our duty.'"
"Your duty?"
I asked. "What is your duty?" Andrea wetted his lips with his tongue and looked at her again, and her look was like a blade in his hand. "Your wife has a lover," he said. "She caught my arm as I flung myself on him. He is 10 times stronger than I, but you remember how I made him howl for mercy in the old days, when he used to bully you." "Let me go," I said to his wife. "He must live to unsay it." Andrea began to whimper. "Oh, my poor brother, I would give my heart's blood to unsay it. The secret has been killing us," she chimed in. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.